For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with former U.S. Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who also is, of course, in addition to being a very, very well-known political commentator, also a prolific author of some 41 books. The most recent is titled Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. This is a book in which Newt Gingrich sets out what he believes is a successful path forward for the political right and the Republican Party, and also seeks to put into context President Biden's victory. And he does not see this as a turning point, but rather as a kind of a temporary bump in the road. And he sees all kinds of positive signs for those of his political persuasion, and writes about that very forcefully in this new book published by Center Street Publishing, again titled Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. Newt Gingrich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you, and I would say that I think of the Biden process as sort of a detour. We're going in a certain direction. We have temporarily lost our way, but we're going to get back on track, I think, by 2024, starting with 2022, and actually in some ways starting with the recent election and the results in Virginia and elsewhere. So I deliberately did not write an anti-Biden book because I figured that Biden and Harris would prove themselves to be anti enough that you didn't need to pile on. Yeah. I was concerned about, for America's future, what do we do if we get back in charge, and how do we do it? And Beyond Biden is really an effort to describe what we need to get done to get this country to be able to compete with China and to be able to create a better future for our children and grandchildren.
I want to ask you about the shortest and in some ways simplest word in the subtitle of your book, Rebuilding the America We Love. Who do you mean by we, rebuilding the America we love? Who is we?
I think, the book is aimed at everybody, Democrat, Republican, Independent, who loves America. If you're concerned about our future, if you want to make sure that the Chinese don't dominate us, if you want to find a solution to thousands of Americans living homelessly, or if you think that it's important that our schools actually teach so young people can learn enough to earn a living and to be good citizens, you know, everybody who broadly agrees with those kind of goals, this book is for them. It's not a Republican book or a conservative book. It's an American book, and it's about what America has to do to be a successful country in the future.
You describe yourself at one point in the book as cheerfully partisan, and of course that's not exactly late breaking news for anybody who knows who you are, and you are perfectly upfront about that. And yet, as you just said, you have, at least in some respects, endeavored to write a book that is not supposed to be about why the Republicans are right, all the Republicans are right, and all the Democrats are wrong. I mean, you are calling us to kind of rise above this dichotomy of blue, red, Democrat, Republican, and so on.
Sure.
And yet, your book really... Yes, but your book, on the other hand, really written with a very, in a sense, partisan flavor, in which you do not pull any punches whatsoever in terms of what bothers you about, for instance, people on the left. How do you, in your mind, kind of reconcile that those two notions of being proudly, cheerfully partisan and yet trying to write a book that rises above what we think of as partisanship?
Well, I worked as a very young man with Ronald Reagan. Reagan always talked about Democrats, Republicans, and independents. He never talked only about Republicans. So I learned it there. When we did the contract with America, it wasn't a contract with conservatives or a contract with Republicans. It was a contract with the whole country. And I think, from my perspective, I'm describing an America which I think probably 80% of the country agrees with. So there are a lot of Democrats who would agree with what I'm saying. And that's sort of what I think Glenn Youngkin discovered running for governor, that he had a lot of people coming out of the woodwork who, on issues like should parents have a say in the schools, there are a lot of Democrats who think that parents ought to be allowed to have some say in their children's education. So it wasn't a purely Democrat-Republican issue. It was really sort of a most of us versus the hard left. And I think in that sense, I'm very happy to work with any Democrat or any independent to try to create a better American future. But it's virtually impossible to work with somebody who is a dedicated big government socialist committed to a set of woke values that I think undermine America.
Mm. I wanted to talk to you about the word radical that appears quite a lot in the book. You talk at great length about the radical left. And as I saw those words repeatedly through the course of your book, Beyond Biden, it occurred to me that that could potentially mean two different things. It could mean, on the one hand, that the left is radical or has become radical, or it might mean that you're asked when you're talking about the radical left, those in the left who are radical. And that's two very different things. One paints the left as radical collectively. The other is taking aim at a radical element within the left in the same way that we might talk about radicals on the right and so on. How are you using that term, radical left? Is it with a broad stroke or is it more selective in terms of an element within the left?
I think it's a fact-based language. In August, when Bernie Sanders, who was a self-avowed socialist, moved a huge bill that was, trillions and trillions of dollars, there was not a single moderate Democrat in Congress. I mean, every single Democrat in the Senate and every single Democrat in the House voted yes to move the bill forward. Now, so I guess you could say I'm starting from a behavior-based attitude. A very large part of the left, and you can argue what percent, but certainly the dynamic, dominant part of the left has now become extraordinarily radical. I mean, to such a degree that you end up with things like a huge stone at the University of Wisconsin, which had been there for over 100 years, was taken out because there was a 1923 newspaper story that described it in racial terms. Now, the stone itself was just a stone, but the radicals on campus found that as an excuse to be angry and upset. When you have people who are opposed to Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, fought a civil war and freed the slaves and was deeply committed to integration in the South, when that's inadequate, that person is a genuine radical. And they're describing an America that I think never existed. And they want to brainwash our children into a series of ideas that I think are just false.
Hmm. When you criticize the Democratic Party, at one point you You call into question their belief in a world that doesn't exist. And you say, I think you think of this as one of kind of the core problems right now with the attitude of the Democrats, and why you think they are destined for a dramatic reversal from their more recent fortunes. What's behind those intriguing words that the Democrats believe in a world that doesn't exist?
Well, let's take the example of violence. It's very, very hard for people on the left to deal with the rising murder rate, which has been the fastest rising in American history, to deal with terrorism, to deal with the aggressiveness of China and Russia. And it hit me one day that sort of the best analogy is there are people who saw The Lion King as a documentary and really do believe that lions and zebras sing and dance together. Now, as you know, lions actually eat zebras, so they don't exactly have a close social relationship. But when you deal with people, for example, who want no bail, so if you rob a bank, the police turn you in, 2 hours later you're back on the street. They actually had a guy in New York City who had been picked up like for three consecutive weeks robbing banks, and he finally turned and said to the policeman, I said, what do I have to do to actually get locked up? Because he wanted to go back to prison where they would feed him and give him medical care and take care of him, and he couldn't get him to do it. And they have no notion. I did a podcast recently at Gingrich 360 with Chief Bratton, who had been the brilliant designer with Giuliani of turning New York around until it became the safest big city in the United States. And he also done the same thing in Boston. He did the same thing in Los Angeles. And we talked about the degree to which the left just can't understand what it takes to be safe. And so they put all these murderers and rapists back on the street, and then they're shocked that they actually turn out to be murderers and rapists. And I think that's what you're talking about. That's the challenge we have.
We're speaking with Newt Gingrich about his latest book called Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. Mr. Gingrich, early in the book, you are talking about what you like to call the red, white, and blue American majority, which kind of transcends what we think of as the red-blue dichotomy. And you have a list of what might be thought of as core tenets, and by no means is this meant to be a complete list, but a number of things in which the vast majority of Americans can very happily and securely agree. I mean, and they include things as basic as America is the greatest country in the world, but there are a lot of other things there as well. Where did that come from? That is, where did that specific list come from? Explain the project that kind of created this list.
Well, we have Bernie Marcus actually approached us in 2017. He knew I'd worked with Reagan, and he knew that I had worked with the Contract with America. And so he asked me, could we see, if it's possible, to find issues that bring so many Americans together that you create an American majority, not a Republican majority, and you begin to have enough unity that you could get very big reforms changed. So we went and worked with several pollsters, John McLaughlin more than anybody else, and we began doing focus groups and we began doing polling. And you find things, for example, like after all this talk about critical race theory, that if you ask people, was Reverend Martin Luther King right about the content of your character being more important than the color of your skin, that's 91% of the American people. So the first thing, anybody ought to do when you're approached by a reporter about this controversy is you ought to say, let's start with content of character. And you saw it vividly in the Virginia governor's race, where on the Sunday before the election, the Democratic candidate, the former governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, said there were too many white teachers. Now, that's a purely racist comment, and was the opposite of what Reverend King was referring to. And so you have an opportunity to say, wait a second, do you care more about the skin color of your child's teacher, or do you care more about whether the teacher is an effective teacher? And I think when you deal with a country which is as ethnically diverse as we are, I mean, you can't just talk about black and white. You have to talk about Latinos, Chinese Americans, Vietnamese Americans, Korean Americans, Japanese Americans, Indian Americans, Pakistani Americans. We're an amazingly diverse country. And I think the left tries to reduce this to black and white, largely because they feel so driven by the need to keep the black community unified against Republicans. It's all gradually falling apart.
Let me just ask you, though, about that question of skin color, because you're touching on a really significant issue. I think one of the things that probably you have to be careful about is when people like you and I, who are white Americans, say the color of the skin shouldn't matter at all. I mean, there's certainly truth to those words. On the other hand, isn't there a problem if children go to a school and they don't see a single teacher that looks anything like they are? I mean, isn't it important for us to kind of think about children who are not white and who they see in positions of leadership? Isn't that a situation in which we need to think about the color of people's skin and why we don't see anybody of that color in certain roles?
First of all, even by McAuliffe standards, 50% of the teachers in Virginia are not white. But take the example of Chicago. There are 179 languages in the Chicago schools. Now, what is the possibility that a child who is Hmong or Cambodian or Pakistani is going to end up in a classroom where the teacher might be black, but they're not going to be Hmong? They're not going to be Pakistani. So should we say, gee, we now have to figure out a way to reorganize all of the children in Chicago so each child gets a person who looks like them?
So I think you're calling into question.
That's the opposite of the American model.
And I think you're calling into question what might be kind of a simplistic understanding of a complicated situation. I mean, or simplistic solutions that create other problems. That's a theme we see quite often in your book.
Should I quit watching the NBA because such a large percent of the great basketball players are African American? I mean, you know, when's the last time we had a great Vietnamese NBA player?
Right.
I just think the idea, if you reduce life to skin color, you have really dramatically weakened America.
Right, and you see that as profoundly anti-American.
Yeah, it undermines and destroys the core value of America, which is that every single one of us is endowed by our Creator with the right to pursue happiness. Every single one of us, of every background.
Right.
Now, we have to fix things to make that possible, but a lot of those fixes are things that the left will bitterly oppose. You have to have good schools. Every child has to get a first-rate education. And yet it is precisely the teachers' unions who will fight against reform.
In terms of that list of things that we can all agree on, or a large majority of Americans agree on, there are, it's interesting, some things that maybe a lot of people agree on, and yet it would be, might seem strange to include on your list. For instance, most of the polls I see show an increasing majority of Americans believe that two adults who love each other should be allowed to marry each other, even if it's two men or two women. And of course, that's a question in which you will really see ferocious opposition, even if numerically a majority of Americans agree on that. Is it enough that we just have a majority who agree on a given issue for that to be part of this so-called American majority? Or do we have to be more careful on that list?
Well, I think you have to start with how big is the majority. I mean, the list we have, the smallest support is 74% for able-bodied adults being required to work for government benefits. That's 3 out of every 4 Americans. Most of these are above 80%, 87%. 81% think Americans should have photo identification if they're going to vote. That's 4 out of every 5 Americans. 85% think that government should protect religious liberty, which is the opposite of the view, of course, of the hard left, which is very anti-religious. So I think it partly depends on what you're trying to do. I think most Americans today are against discrimination against, for example, the people you're describing, gays and lesbians. But at the same time, they don't particularly want to have six-year-olds taught that they should be thinking about gender.
Right. A last question, if I may. In your book, you characterize the left as having its power and influence very much concentrated in our three largest metropolitan areas, that is New York City and Chicago and Los Angeles. And there's certainly plenty of truth to those words. And you call into question the left's neglect of so much of America, not listening to that kind of to much of America, particularly in the Midwest and rural America and so on. I'm just curious, though, those three gigantic metropolitan areas, people live there. Americans live there, and they count too. Is there a possibility that lack of listening is going in both directions? I mean, those are Americans whose wishes should not be ignored or marginalized just because they live in these big metropolitan areas. How would you have us think about this nation collectively? I mean, not only that broad expanse of red states that we see on maps, but also those metropolitan areas that are heavily populated by Americans.
Even in the metropolitan areas, there is a movement away from the left. You just had a former policeman elected as mayor of New York on a very tough anti-crime position. You have the largest number of votes for the Republican Party by county is Los Angeles County because it's such a huge county. And they get well over a million votes for Republicans in Los Angeles County. But when I talk about the big cities, what I'm really talking about is the elites. And the elites who run the news media, the elites who run the universities. And it is those elites who I think there's a great book called Coming Apart that came out about 2012. And it really outlines the notion that you have these very small areas, literally precincts and zip codes, that have people that, as the author puts it, people who go to Princeton, Yale, and Harvard marry people who go to Princeton, Yale, and Harvard and live in neighborhoods next to people who went to Princeton, Yale, and Harvard. And they are totally isolated from most of America. I used to kid them and tell them one of the reasons they didn't understand Trump was that The Apprentice wasn't on PBS and didn't follow Downton Abbey. And therefore, no reporter had ever seen The Apprentice and had any idea what Trump had done on television. And I think it's this whole notion of, you know, the kind of people that Hillary Clinton made fun of, and the whole notion of, as one liberal said, all those people who go to, you know, who go to Walmart. Well, you know, the vast, vast, vast majority of the country, even in the big cities, end up going to places like Walmart and Target and Costco. And it tells you about the elites that they have contempt for people who go to those kind of stores.
Thank you for your time. Newt Gingrich, the author of Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. Appreciate
Great.
Your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We step back in history today to the war between the states from a very, very interesting perspective, courtesy of author James Perry. He has written a book called Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. Mr. Perry examines the Civil War experiences of five men who all went on to be president. We all know Ulysses S. Grant, the leading Union general during the Civil War, but you may not know anything at all about the Civil War involvement of Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, or William McKinley. And this book really takes us into the heart of the experience of these five men. And also, along the way, we really learn a great deal about the Civil War and what this experience was like for our country and for the people who were caught up in its grip. James Perry is responsible for all kinds of articles and five previous books. The one he wrote most recently, which I've not yet seen but really want to, is called A Bohemian Brigade, apparently talking about the reporters who covered the Civil War. We have James Perry with us today to talk about this most recent book, Touched with Fire. James Perry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Glad to be here.
What a wonderful idea for a book. How did you get the idea?
Well, in doing a Bohemian Brigade, the one you just mentioned, I kept bumping into these fellows, and I thought, well, you know, what did they do in the Civil War? I mean, I knew about Grant, of course, but what did these others do in the Civil War? And sure enough, the more I got into it, the more amazed I was to discover just how active they all were and how much combat they'd seen, and that this was the defining moment of their lives. This is what they really thought was the most important thing they'd ever done, was being the Boys in Blue, saving the Union, being the great generation of their era. So I said, nobody's ever written this book, so let's give it a go.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you did. You give us some good information in the book's introduction. One of the things you remind us about is the fact that many of our U.S. presidents through history have had some sort of soldier experience as well, and some of them very, very significant experience.
Oh, yes. Well, it all starts, of course, from George Washington right on to Eisenhower. Sure, we've always, for a country that doesn't always think that the military is something that we should be too close to, has managed to send an immense amount of, a large number of military and naval veterans to the White House.
You also mentioned the fact that we are talking with the Civil War about a unique occurrence in our country's history. You say Americans have never known anything like the Civil War. You call it the most wrenching of all U.S. wars.
Oh, I think that's true, and that's why it reverberates still with such intensity. I mean, it's been estimated that if the same proportion of casualties to population occurred today as occurred in the Civil War, we'd lose 5 million men and women. And now, of course, that's amazing. Imagine if we would ever be involved in a war in which we'd lose 5 million people.
Hmm. You also mentioned the fact that in covering the Civil War experiences of these five future presidents, that you end up covering the Western theater of the Civil War, which you say has been very much neglected by historians over the years. Explain to us why that has been the case, why so little has been written about the Civil War battles out West, and why they are significant apart from the lives of these five future presidents.
Well, I mean, the reason I say that in this book, of course, all except for Grant, of course, but most of these did all their fighting in the West. Well, you know, the Civil War buffs, they're constantly fascinated by Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and the whole Virginia experience, you know, those two armies locked against each other for all that period of time. And that's perfectly sound. I mean, I have no objection to that. But a huge amount of fighting went on in the West. And just anything over the mountains, you know, and the Mississippi Valley and Ohio. And this was extremely important. I mean, the whole business of opening up the Mississippi and cutting the Confederacy in half, that was crucial. And I was talking to one day and said, why didn't Lincoln bring Grant back and let him hang all that time at Vicksburg? Well, taking Vicksburg was immensely important. I mean, that opened the Mississippi River the whole length for commerce and cutting that part of the South in half. So yes, I think, well, this is highly subjective, but I think the Western soldiers and the Western officers were more interesting. You know, they always thought that they marched better, they fought longer, that they were tougher than these sort of effete Eastern soldiers. You know, and whether that's true or not can be argued, but that's what they felt, and that's what many of these people I write about here felt. They felt they were the prize soldiers in the Union Army, the ones from the West.
You cast an interesting distinction between Ulysses S. Grant and the other four future presidents whom you talk about in the book, mm-hmm. Grant being the only professional soldier among the five, the others being civilian volunteers.
Exactly.
Explain the difference to us.
Well, he was a West Pointer, of course, and had served 15 years in the Army and had fought in the war with Mexico. He was a real soldier, and these others, of course, had not the faintest idea what being a soldier was all about, and until they actually went off to war. Grant knew what it was about, and he showed his aggressiveness right in his very first battle, which I describe in this book at Belmont. And so there's the difference. I mean, all the major battles in the Civil War, this is very unusual, and almost all of them, 55 out of 60, both armies were commanded by West Pointers.
Hmm.
And they thought they were the true professionals, and they always had a good bit of suspicion about these volunteers, particularly the political generals, the ones who are striving to make a reputation so they could back home and run for office. The sort of person they had in mind was James Garfield, who was very political and very devious and very tricky, and they didn't like him at all.
You mentioned the fact that at some point in the book, and I like the way you put it, so I'm trying to find the exact quote, you mentioned something about how this was maybe the last time in history where, early on at least, in the Civil War, where you had people signing up. Oh, here it is. They were volunteers eager and patriotic in ways that the young men who followed them never were. That maybe the first volunteers in the Civil War are the last of the innocently enthusiastic volunteers.
Right, that happens in some wars. In World War One, when England sent off all the flower of its young men, and they all were chewed up in those terrible battles, that there was the same thing then, it was the same thing here, that they went off and they thought it was something of a lark to begin with, and then it became this extraordinarily terrible, brutal, bloody war, and that would make anybody think twice, I think.
We're speaking with James M. Perry, author of Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. Before delving into some specifics, I want to find out a little bit about how you went about writing this book and amassing all the information that you did. I have to say that's one of the things which, one of the strongest impressions I'm left with, having read the book, is I am amazed at how much we know, the amount of very specific and sometimes sort of trivial information,
right,
which is left behind, I suppose, in all kinds of different ways. What are the sorts of resources of which you availed yourself in writing this book and giving it such remarkable detail?
Well, the wonderful thing about that period was that they wrote diaries and letters. And Rutherford B. Hayes, my favorite of all of them, I think, wrote a diary entry every day of his adult life, and all those entries are available at a wonderful institution called the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Center in Fremont, Ohio. And he and his wife Lucy wrote back and forth all the time, and those letters are all preserved. Now, you can go to the library and look them up, or you can go to their website, and they're all right there on the website. The websites are suddenly, particularly the responsible ones, of course, are wonderful, wonderful places to find information. Other than that, I live just 8 miles from the Library of Congress, of course.
Ah.
And that's crucial. And the presidential papers are there, and all the other, lots of other papers are there. And you can spend the rest of your life going through all of that. It's just a wonderful depository of all kinds of information.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting, however, you mentioned at one point, for instance, General Grant, in talking about one of the first battles which you discuss, he is rather cavalier and inaccurate about numbers when he talks about the number of soldiers under his command and the number of Confederate soldiers which they met in battle. I mean, he's off by many thousands,
right,
although maybe we're talking about an era when it wasn't necessarily easy to know those sorts of things.
It wasn't. Even when his great success that I go to Fort Donelson when they captured all those Confederate soldiers at Fort Donelson, nobody to this day knows how many there were, and those things just don't get counted very well. And the estimates is around 15,000, but who knows? It might have been 12,000, it might have been 18,000, but But we don't know. But Grant wrote his memoirs, of course, and they're not always accurate, but they're a wonderful source because they're beautifully written, and their letters and papers, all those. I try to just use contemporary material as much as humanly possible in this book,
mm-hmm.
in all books.
You mentioned at one point that military intelligence just didn't exist then, as of course it does now. And one of these five gentlemen, I remember you writing specifically about that being one of their greatest aims, to try to shore up the whole matter of scouts and so
right.
on, to just try to get more information.
Right. Garfield was probably the smartest of the bunch of these five. It is said he could write in Latin with one hand and in Greek with the other simultaneously. And he was very good on intelligence. I mean, my favorite chapter in the book, I think, is this obscure campaign in the Big Sandy Valley in eastern Kentucky. This is the Hatfield-McCoy territory. Back in those days, this was not a place they really wanted to visit. And he was opposed by a wonderful Falstaffian figure named Humphrey Marshall, a 300-pound Confederate general. And they had this campaign that doesn't appear in hardly any history books. And the one thing Garfield did very well is that he had all these scouts and spies that he knew a lot more about where Humphrey Marshall was than Humphrey Marshall ever knew about where he was. And this came in very handy. But most of them didn't do very well at that sort of thing. I think it was because Garfield had a devious nature, right? And he was tricky and devious. And I say he was kind of a combination of Lyndon Johnson and Bill Clinton. So that kind of naturally appealed to him to send out scouts in disguise and racing through the night on horses to scout out information. But he was good at it.
Hmm. You mentioned at one point that this was the first war in which news was rapidly relayed by the telegraph.
Yeah. Lightning, they called it.
Right. It isn't maybe central to our discussion today, but I would love to just get a thought or two from you on the significance of that, or the difference that you think that made in maybe the way this war was fought, or the way in which the public saw it.
I deal with that a lot in that earlier book you mentioned, A Bohemian Greg, was the reporters used the telegraph, of course, to file their stories, at least when they could, when the armies hadn't seized the telegraph and wouldn't let them use it. But that was very important. The telegraph, steam was immensely important. The steam to drive the big presses that printed all these mass circulation newspapers, steam to power trains. You could move troops very rapidly, you know, by steam, by train or by boat, by steamboat, or you could move reporters pretty rapidly for that matter. So it was really technologically quite an extraordinary advance over anything we'd known before.
Hmm. When we talk about Garfield, at one point you mentioned the fact that he became... In effect, the commanding officer of the 42nd Ohio Volunteers. Mm-hmm. At that moment in time, he was the only one.
Yeah,
it was
right.
up to him to recruit the other 999.
He took that responsibility on. He was supposed to go out and recruit the rest of the regiment.
I mean,
that was not unusual.
I mean, it's not unusual, but it's just a staggering thing to think about.
1,000 men. See if you can go out and recruit 1,000 men to go off to war. You
exactly.
Know, it's not an easy thing. Of course, he was at that point connected with Hiram College, which is now Hiram College, of course, the Western Reserve Eclectic Institute then. And a good many of his soldiers in the first round there were students at that college. But he was good at it. They were all fairly well known in their own communities. And these regiments were all recruited locally, of course. So they if they had a reputation, if they were known, and they could manage to turn up a good many more men than you would think.
Hmm. Let's talk about your favorite of the five, Rutherford Picard Hayes. You
yeah.
call him at one point a classic amateur soldier. In what way?
Well, he understood that these people were not professional soldiers, and that you could not tell them what to do without explaining to them why you were telling them what to do. There's a wonderful example in the book. I thought it was a wonderful example, at least, which they were about to be reviewed by General Fremont, one of the very worst generals in the whole war, but they didn't know it at that point, I suppose. And they'd been issued these old musket rifles.
Oh, yeah, awful old guns.
Yeah, this didn't work very well. And they said that they, damned if they were going show up and accept these weapons. They wanted something more modern and better, and so they revolted. They weren't going to do it, and the commander, the commanding, the people commanded above Hayes said, if you don't accept these weapons, we're going to shoot you. We're going to really take care of you. And Hayes says that was no way to do it. So he went and sat down and talked to the troops and said, you know, in the revolution, the American Revolution, George Washington's men sometimes didn't have any weapons either. They had to go to war with axes and scythes and all sorts of terrible pikes and that sort of thing. And if it was good enough for George Washington's men, it ought to be good enough for you. And they came around to saying, yeah, he's right about that. And so he reasoned with them is what he did. And that's what the only way you could really command these volunteer troops was to reason with them and explain what it was you had in mind. And Hayes was just brilliant at doing that.
Right. You say at one point he knew nothing about soldiering. But
well,
he was...
early on, they all studied up on books on drilling and small unit tactics and that sort of thing. But other than that, they knew nothing at
sure.
all, of course. No.
But you call Hayes a thoroughly decent and honorable man. And
I think so, yeah. Yes, he is.
I was really struck by a moment when, I don't know if it's just before they're to be going off to maybe one of their first battles. I think it's the 4th of July, actually. And this is actually something in the Journal of William McKinley, the youngest of these five.
Right.
Who recalls...
Only 18 years old, yeah.
Right, who recalls what occurred. And one of the things which happened at this gathering of soldiers was Rutherford B. Hayes, a major, reading the Declaration of Independence to
right.
the regiment.
Well, they were very, very patriotic early on. Some of them are quite religious, too. They're strong religious, except for Grant. Hayes was an unbeliever at the start of the war, and then he wrote this diary entry later in the war. It said that, you know... He's coming around. That by as his life went on, he figured he would return to the church, and the war had done that. The others were, Harrison was very religious. McKinley, as a young man, was deeply religious as he went to war.
William McKinley, as you said, 18 years old. You say the Civil War was McKinley's undergraduate education.
Yeah, he never. He went to Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, very briefly. And then it either was the family finances or health problems at home, and he never finished. So he never got to go to college like the others. The others are all college graduates. And so that really was his undergraduate education, the Civil War.
Right. A striking moment in the book is when you quote a letter that young McKinley sends to his mother. He's talking about going on one of these bushwhacker patrols,
right.
as he calls them, and it's kind of a humorous little story about...
Right.
Go ahead.
The officer thought early on these days they were constantly thinking they were surrounded by enemy guerrillas or bushwhackers, whatever you want to call them. And I think this is a time when you're thinking of when his commanding officer thought there was one lurking in the bushes. So he took his sword and plunged it in there instead of coming up with a Confederate. He apparently plunged it into a skunk, and it caused a tremendous reaction. Troops thought it was hilarious
right.
at the time.
Well, we have this letter excerpt from McKinley, but then a diary excerpt from about the same time in which he says, "Tomorrow's sun will undoubtedly find me on the march. It may be I may never see the light of another day.
Right,
should this be
dramatic.
My fate, I fall in a good cause and hope to fall in the arms of my blessed Redeemer."
Right.
I mean, it's so striking to hear such mature words from a teenager.
Is. Yes, they. I think they matured at a younger age back then. I'm sure that's true. But these were quite remarkable men, remember. These were all... You don't get to be President of the United States if you don't have some qualities of leadership and some some intelligence, though that make two or three presidents you might wonder about. But basically, these were well-educated, thoughtful men. And in two cases, I mean, Grant was 38, and so was Hayes. They weren't young men. Garfield was 29, Harrison 27, and McKinley 18 at the time the war began. So, except for McKinley, they were all pretty well formed in personality and the character.
We should mention Benjamin Harrison. We haven't really talked about him yet, and he, of course, comes out of a very impressive lineage.
Yes, his grandfather, of course, was old Tippecanoe himself, old William Henry Harrison. His father was a congressman. And he was terribly conscious all his life of this burden of this this family tradition that he wanted to make sure that he upheld all through his life. He was not a very likable person. I didn't like him much researching him, and nobody really liked him much very whole lot back then. He was cold, kind of cold fish. I said at one point there was sort of an Nixonian quality to him in that he had very little small talk, and like Nixon. Nixon had none. I'm an old political writer, and I used to cover Nixon. So you have to work hard to work up much affection for him.
You also mentioned the fact that Benjamin Harrison, of these five, it took him longer than any of the others to enter the war.
That may well have been. There's a question here. His commanding officer was a fellow named Ward. He called him his incubus all the time, and Ward was a drunkard. And I think the commanders were a little reluctant to put these Indiana boys into combat with this drunkard in command. So that might have held them back some. But when they did finally get committed to combat in Sherman's March to the Sea, I mean, he saw more action in that short period of time than his grandfather had ever seen. I mean, you know, he saw a huge amount of fighting and was actually a very important figure at a battle called Peachtree Creek outside of Atlanta, in which he repulsed a major Confederate attack and really pretty much saved the day. So he did some good fighting. You have to give him credit for that.
You say fairly bluntly in the book's introduction that none of these five typically shows up on a list of our outstanding presidents.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes that is because of sort of historical circumstances, that sometimes a given president just isn't president at a very pivotal moment in history, and sometimes it's for other reasons beyond their control. What is your sense of these five? I mean, did they come to the presidency as capable presidents, and to what extent did their Civil War experience figure in that?
Well, if you were running for president as a Republican back at post-Civil War in the Gilded Age, so-called, you had to be pretty much had to be a Union veteran, and these all qualified for that. And but it was the Gilded Age. It was a time of a lot of corruption, a lot of cheating, commercial expansion, and everybody thought the president just should stand out of the way. The president shouldn't be involved in all this. Let the country move forward, do everything they wanted to do. And the Congress itself was corrupt, and it was a very difficult time to bring the country into any kind of orderly way of proceeding. And one big question was Reconstruction in the South, of course. And Grant tried a little, and one of his biographers says by the end of his second term, there wasn't a single person in the White House that gave a damn about the Negro, about what we call African Americans today. And I think that's probably true. By the time Hayes got to be president, there were only federal troops really enforcing those laws in one or two states, and so it was pretty much over. We can argue that they should have done much more, of course. After that, that was pretty much put aside, and other things were occurring, but it was a tough time to be president.
Well, and of course, to be part of the Civil War is no easy matter as well. So they all survive, of course, and see much and experience much.
Two of them got assassinated, of course, poor souls, after all that time.
That's right. Two of the five do not survive their presidencies.
They were both assassinated, right.
Yes. The book is a fascinating one. Again, it's called Touched with Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. And the book goes into marvelous depth and detail in describing the specific battles and engagements which were experienced by these five Americans. The book is published by Public Affairs. The author, again, James M. Perry. James Perry, I really enjoyed the book and enjoyed the experience of speaking with you about it on the morning show today. I thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, too.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with the author and illustrator of a wonderful new book for children that I think just about anybody of any age would enjoy. If you are the least bit curious about the brilliantly talented musician Jimi Hendrix, the book is titled
The Song of Jimi Hendrix. Also, from the archives, a conversation with Mark Elliott talking about his really wonderful biography of the brilliant Paul Simon. It's exactly 9.